You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Lambros is the author of Policing the Beats, which is his book that he is going to be signing in about an hour. So you can head around there and join him for that signing. And this book rewinds the tape to show how music has been used as an instrument for policing Black people. Some of the comments are around this book, around that it's a journey, it's empowering. And we're so lucky to have Lambros here for his very first green belt. We've all had a first green belt. I want you to think about how that feels as you give him the loudest cheer and welcome him to the stage. Please welcome Lambros Fatsis.
Hello everyone, thank you for being here. I was actually thinking of joining you sort of on the front. Shall I? Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, because it feels a bit awkward just being here, right? I might need a stool or a log or something, but thank you. Wow, that's very kind. Thanks. I've got a lot of gear, water, notes, books, people, trees, leaves, air. Right, okay. So basically, I came all the way from Brighton having read a story that the BBC published only yesterday about the Met police insisting on using drill music as evidence in court. And because there's so many things that are wrong about this, I took the very first train from Brighton and came all the way here to tell you everything about why this is essentially wrong. But before I do that, I wanted to read a brief passage from the book itself just to set the issue in its context. And then what I'm going to try and do is take apart that news story bit by bit to see what we make of it, right? So that you know what I think about it and then see what you might end up thinking about the whole thing. So let me read a little bit from the book. Okay, so the passage I'm going to read is very short, and it follows a description of the cover, which you can see here, which itself is a painting by Tam Joseph called The Spirit of the Carnival, which he painted after the 1976 Notting Hill uprisings, as I would call them, Notting Hill riots, as they are known. And Tam Joseph, I was quite fortunate that he agreed to let me use the painting as the cover for the book. So the passage goes a bit like this. If you need an image for all this, look no further than Tam Joseph's The Spirit of the Carnival, which graces the cover of this book and depicts a wall of riot shields and a snarling dog forming a circle around a carnival masquerader at the center of the scene. From North America and South America to carnivals in the Caribbean and its diasporas, the question of why cops saunter along with their truncheons to take a swing at jazz, clamp down on capoeira, or contain carnival goers refuses to go away. What is it about such musics that exposes them to such harsh policing? That is the question that this book grapples with, as a study of the policing of Black or Afro-diasporic musics from the era of imperial colonial slavery to the present day. Much of this history resembles the plot of Adal Maldonado's protest dance piece La Mambopera, which depicts the criminalization of African rhythms. A dancer is brought to trial for allegedly causing a heart attack with her ancestral movements. But why would African rhythms have such a dangerous impact on white audiences? Could it be that they were perceived and policed as a threat to the sensory, cultural, and political integrity of white mainstream society? To answer such questions, we must turn to the history of policing against Black musics. But we must also reckon with, confront and expose the racist ideologies and the imperial colonial context that made associations between Blackness and danger possible in the first place. That is what this book does by tracing the policing of Black music to its imperial colonial origins in order to explain why news stories about criminal drill rappers sweep the nation's media and political discourse and fill the respectable, law-abiding public with dread. If anyone wishes to understand why the latest rap subgenres are tainted with the stain of criminality today, a closer look at the long history of state-sanctioned, racialized criminalization of black music is needed. And this book provides it, how very humble of me, by discussing how the musics of the African diaspora have been silenced in Britain's colonies and at home too. So that's the book. Or at least part of the book, like literally one page of the 300 or so pages of the book. So let's return to the BBC story, right? So let's say you open up your browser, you read that story, and you would probably be thinking, well, the Met must know something for them to say that, right? They must know something so that they would insist that it is so vitally important to be using, you know, drill music videos and lyrics as evidence of criminal wrongdoing. So what I want to do is kind of retrace our steps and follow that sort of logic. Which would be, okay, fine. How would they know about such cases, right? One way in which that they would know about such cases would be that they've worked on them, right? That they've been instructed by the prosecution to act as experts in such cases. That would be one option, and we're going to get to that in a moment. Another way in which they might know about such cases would be through reading media stories like the one that I started this talk with, right? So they would go to BBC and they would have read of cases of, you know, drill rapper charged with such and such, you know, murder for blah, 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 blah. Brilliant. But that doesn't actually tell us how the outcome of such cases came to be. We know nothing, for example, the only thing we know is basically a court verdict. We don't know how that verdict was reached. We don't know what case the prosecution made. We don't know what evidence was used. We don't know which experts were instructed. We don't know what their expertise is in. We don't know how they got that expertise. We don't know what counter-arguments were heard in court by their defense. We don't know what experts were instructed by their defense. So there's a lot we don't know when we read such a headline that would convince us that, or at least imply that the Met must know something to insist that, you know, such material is so vital to them. So what I want to start with is the rather provocative kind of proposition that a court verdict is actually simply evidence of court procedure successfully concluded, that it is not proof of guilt or innocence in any way. Okay? Precisely because there's so much we don't know, like the bits that I mentioned. And it is those things that we don't know that we should know, and that I want I want us to pay attention to for a moment. So, for example, I'm getting a bit distracted by the music in the background. Now, obviously, contrary to the headline. And there was a video that actually preceded that headline that the Met published where cops insisted that music making and videos can count as evidence, which obviously is something that I would dispute because, you know, I think unless something is conclusive as a bit of evidence, i.e. CCTV footage, DNA samples, then anything else is just circumstantial or just used to patch up a case that might not actually have, you know, much grounding to it. And of course, the reason why we need to know that the evidence that we're presented with is conclusive is to make sure that we can actually use the word justice when it comes to such procedures. Otherwise, we can say, well, anything goes, right? I can just charge you because you wear the wrong clothes or because I don't like your face or because, you know, there's just something that I can create a story around and convince people as to why you might find somebody guilty or not. But if we want to retain the word justice in relation to court proceedings, then we have to be thorough. In order to be thorough, we need to be rigorous. In order to be rigorous, we need to make sure that what we present the jury with is actual hard evidence. Otherwise, you know, we don't actually have a case. And if we don't have a case, then why are we in court in the first place, right? And I'm glad we're not, and we're in those, you know, beautiful surroundings. So let's start with, you know, evidence itself, right? The main problem is that such material is allowed, you know, as evidence in the first place, when it clearly isn't, at least from my point of view. And then you'd be thinking, okay, you rely on that evidence. And in order to bolster their case, they would instruct the police themselves as experts. And of course, this is where you'd be thinking, well, okay, how and why would cops be instructed as experts? You know, what would they be experts in? Right? Are they experts in rap music? Are they experts in black culture? How do they acquire such expertise? Right? And a lot of them will say, well, you know, I've been an officer who has been policing gangs for a very long time, and therefore I know the language and I can understand the context, and therefore I can decipher lyrics, and therefore I can explain them and sort of tease out the truthfulness of such material and be able to defend it in court. But that to me sounds a little bit like saying, well, I've been working in a pub in Cambridge where Shakespearean scholars meet every week. And I'm an expert in soliloquy, of course. Why? Because I've been hearing all those Shakespearean scholars, you know, whilst I'm pulling pints for them for the past 10 years or so. You know, like, you need to have a direct experience or knowledge of something in order to count yourself as an expert, or, you know, to be qualified as an expert on any matter. But the reality is even worse. First of all, you know, the police officers that are instructed as experts certify themselves as experts. You heard this right. Certified themselves as experts. Like, I'm sure you can walk into a courtroom and say, you know, I'm an expert in DNA, right? So I can explain and interpret DNA evidence. How? Well, because I can certify myself, right? Of course, you can't do that, right? But cops can do that. So they just sign a self-certification form that allows them to pose and act as experts in court. So that's one way. Another way is that they will say, well, actually, I've undergone rigorous training to handle such material. Let me tell you what that rigorous training is. That rigorous training is a 5-day course, right, that is organized by somebody who headed a unit called Project Alpha, which was found in breach of privacy laws. Okay, and that person heads that training. He's now an ex-cop, but he used to work in a lot of those cases and headed Project Alpha. In that 5-day course, the main figure that is paraded around as the expert is somebody who the cops call a professor, who is not professor because he simply has an undergraduate degree, right? He doesn't have a master's, he doesn't have a PhD, he doesn't have a university position, he's not affiliated with any university, so he's hardly a professor, which does matter particularly in the academic world because it's a very specific procedure through which you become a professor, and that means that, you know, you publish research, you have a certain amount of years of teaching under your belt and so on. You can't just call yourself a professor. It's a very specific title. So we already see that, you know, you're in a course that's run by somebody whose credentials are compromised by the fact that his handling of evidence was found in breach of privacy laws. You have someone who's the main figure in that training who calls themselves a professor but is no professor, right? And then when you ask, well, okay, what do they profess being a professor of? It turns out that they're a lexicographer, that is to say, somebody who writes dictionaries. Dictionaries of what, you might ask? Urban slang, as they would say. What is their degree on? French and English literature. So you have somebody with a degree in French and English literature who compiles dictionaries, who claims to know a lot of stuff about urban slang, who assumes that rap lyrics are simply, basically, urban slang set to beats. So it doesn't have poetry of its own, which is obviously clearly not true. So the main figure in that training, you know, as I've told you, is not somebody who you would probably trust, you know, with their interpretation of anything. And that's the five-day course, which is actually not even mostly about drill music evidence. It is actually mostly about court procedure. Okay? So we've got experts who either certify themselves or who go through a course that is an absolute joke by anyone's standards. And these are the experts of that the prosecution instructs. And then you'd be thinking, okay, cool. You know, part of the problem, obviously, is the fact that the prosecution, you know, can then use such material as you know, as evidence, as I've told you. The problem is the fact of, you know, the experts, the so-called experts that they rely on in order to bring such cases. And then you'd be thinking, okay, but what about the law, right? All of this happens in a court of law. So the law must have safeguards to protect against such egregious breaches of what we might expect, right? In terms of standards of evidence and rigor, so that you can actually prove a case, right? Prove a case through evidence. Not present a story, but prove a case. So let's look at the law itself. First of all, the legal guidance that the prosecutions rely on, which they're currently reviewing. We'll see what's going to happen with that. They have a definition of drill music as gang-related music. And you'd be thinking, okay, cool. Where does this definition come from? That definition comes from a blog. It doesn't come from research. It doesn't come from peer-reviewed research. It doesn't come from, you know, any kind of reputable source. It comes from a blog. Written by whom? Written by the ex-cop who headed Project Alpha, who does the five-day training. Okay, and that's the definition that the Crown Prosecution Service relies on in order to present drill music and literally define an entire rap subgenre as nothing more than gang-related music. Okay, brilliant. You may say at this point, well, that's just guidance, which the prosecutors don't have to follow. Well, they kind of do, because that's the guidance that they follow. But let's look at the law itself, which relates to that definition of gang-related. So let's look at what a gang might be in law, shall we? You know, because obviously what you're thinking as I'm telling you all that, obviously, is that I'm a rebel rouser, right? I mean, look where we are. We are at the rebel rouser stage. So why would I be trusted? Okay, so let's go to the law, because we trust the law, don't we? So let's look at the law itself and see how it defines gangs. And the way that the law defines gangs is as follows, and I'm not kidding. In order to define a group as a gang, you need to have three conditions met. The first, that group that one wants to define as a gang needs to consist of at least three people. That's one criterion. The second criterion is that they need to show an emblem or a visible symbol of belonging that by which members recognize themselves as such. Okay? And then the third characteristic is that they need to congregate in a geographical area. So if there's more than three of you here, and there are, and you happen to wear badges that identify you as members of something, and you seem to congregate in a particular geographical area, you fit the criteria for the definition of a gang. So you could be a gang, right? So legally, if I wanted to, if I had the power to enforce the law or just make it up, I could just classify you as a gang. So that's gangs for you. Let's look at the second way in and through which drill music becomes evidence, which is another piece of legislation that is known as bad character evidence. And bad character evidence itself is defined as evidence, and I quote, that doesn't have to, I mean, I'm not quoting verbatim, but the main kind of keywords are there, this is evidence that not of the facts of the case, but of disposition towards misconduct. So this is evidence not of the facts of the case. So evidence that doesn't relate to the facts of the case, but it is evidence of a predisposition towards misconduct. How one might arrive at finding out what predisposition towards misconduct might be, I have no idea. Right? Do they look at a crystal ball? Do they look, peer into the defendant's eyes and somehow are able to just sense something? You know, do they just, you know, stroke the defendant's aura? And if there's something spiky there, they're like, ooh, bad character. So that's evidence of bad character. So that's the second characteristic. The third characteristic, or the third way in which such material becomes evidence in the courtroom, is through joint enterprise legislation. And joint enterprise legislation works a bit like this, which is that it's essentially a way of collective punishment. So it's not, you can charge someone with a joint enterprise conviction even if they're not present at the crime scene, right? But it's guilt by association. So if the police and the prosecutors can show that there's a link between the defendant and people who might have committed a crime, or just any association between members who are defined as, let's say, members of a gang, that's enough to bring collective group prosecutions against, for example, a drill group, right? Or rather, a group of gang-related music. Okay. So you see that through the combination of those three tools, joint enterprise, bad character evidence, and the definition of gangs themselves, you can build a picture and you can portray defendants in a negative light and charge them as if they were indeed gang members. And by the way, it is not illegal to be a gang member, right? So you can paint a picture that essentially a defendant is somebody bad, who does bad things, who belongs to gangs, who do violent things, and so on and so forth. And that's the law. So essentially what I'm painting here is a completely different picture to the one that one might have in mind when reading that BBC headline, right? And while one might read that headline and think, well, you know, the cops must know, the law must be trusted, the courts might know what they do, you know, equally the prosecutors, you know what they're doing and so on. Of course, they all know what they're doing, but none of this amounts to evidence. So to me, it's a story of, evidence that is no evidence, of experts that are no experts, and justice that is no justice. Okay, for precisely the reason that, you know, facts are manipulated out of existence in order to essentially build prosecutions and charge defendants with, crimes that the prosecution would claim would be committed. And to just give you examples of real cases of how this plays out. You might be familiar with the Manchester 10 case or the Mossad 11 case, and I encourage you to look at those. But these are essentially cases. So picking the Mossad 11 case, for example, 11 teenagers from Manchester were charged with over 100 years in prison collectively. So that's about, anyway, more than 10 years per defendant, if not more. My math is terrible, so you can help me with that. And the crime, of course, was that they were in, and I'm quoting the judge here, in possession of a drill music video, right? So not a drill music video that they made, right? Not any kind of allusion to any, you know, type of wrongdoing admitted or at least referred to in that video, but they were in possession of a drill music video. And to make matters worse, they also shot a documentary which was part of a dissertation project which was funded by the Greater Manchester Police and by a youth worker there, by a social worker as well. Okay, so that was the evidence, right? And there's plenty other examples that the, you know, for example, there's examples of people just, you know, being charged for dancing to a drill music video. Okay, so not actually doing anything, not even being in possession of it, right? But just, you know, sort of dancing. So it, you know, some of those cases are really that wild. The Manchester 10 case similarly kind of draws on drill music as evidence of a gang conspiracy, although again the defendants never made that video. Okay, so that's kind of, you know, again something that you have in your possession that is bad enough to charge you with, you know, whatever crimes that the prosecution might sort of dream up against you. And I'm going to use the last couple of minutes before people tell me off to try and kind of convince you that this is nothing new. I mean, I'm sure you will know this and you will have thought about this. And I know that there's a lot of stigma and negative publicity, you know, in relation to drill that would make, you know, a lot of you skeptical think, well, but it is a violent music genre, which of course it is, like Quentin Tarantino's movies are violent and so on and so forth. That's kind of part of the appeal of the genre. Whether we like it or not, that's a whole different story. The point is whether it is evidence of criminal wrongdoing, which is, you know, impossible to find through such means. But what I want to point to is that what if the exact same treatment was meted out to music genres that were not violent? So, for example, what if I were to invite you to think about Calypso in 1930s Trinidad and tell you that it was policed in identical ways to drill music? Where, of course, you'd be thinking about Calypso and you would not be thinking about violence, criminality, and danger. You'd be thinking about the carnival, which is around the corner, by the way, in terms of dates. You'd be thinking about upbeat, joyful, positive music, although he did criticize, you know, British colonial rule, rightly so. But you would not be linking Calypso to danger and criminality and violence, right? Yet it was policed in identical ways to drill music. Okay, so just like drill rappers, for example, need to inform the police in advance of publishing any tracks online, that's exactly what Calypsonians in 1930s Trinidad under British colonial rule needed to do if they wanted to perform the music during Carnival. So the reason why that is instructive is because you can't have two music genres and only one of them being violent but being policed in identical ways. So the conclusion that we draw from that is that there's a longer history of criminalization and policing against, you know, black music. And what my book does is that it traces that all the way back to the era of colonial slavery, from the banning of African drumming to the present day, which is quite a difficult sort of argument to follow. And I've just given you a few glimpses of it all, which is really all that I had time for and all I wanted to achieve. But basically what I would want to do is, and I'm sure you are all of that already, so this is just an excuse to come, you know, here and talk to you sort of under the shade of trees, really, to be even more critical than you already are of media stories that present a particular plot line that actually itself is lacking evidence and proof and the ability to stand up to critical scrutiny, as I've shown you. So, you know, although your instincts and your socialization might point you to the direction of, well, the cops must be right, they must know something, the law must be right, it must, you know, operate under strict requirements of evidence and proof, I want to convince you of a different story, which is to not think about how criminal drill is, but to think about how intense the racist criminalization of drill is instead. And that's, you know, part of the story that the book does, particularly in the later chapters, and indeed, you know, tracing it historically, you know, as I said, as a story of the policing against black musics, you know, from colonialism to the present day. I very much fear that I kind of need to shut up now, but I'm more than welcome to have a chat, you know, with I'm not sure if we're allowed any questions in terms of time, which again I regret, but I'm more than happy to discuss with you if you want to join me for a chat at the book signing or, you know, or around the festival really. But yeah, that's kind of all the time that I had to do this. I hope it was useful, or, you know, whatever it was very short for me. But yeah, I'll stop there. Thank you for listening. It's nice to meet you, and I'm sure I'll meet you a bit more in the next couple of minutes or hours. But yeah, thank you for being here, and see you soon.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.